This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Thursday, a multi-billion dollar loss for one of Australia's biggest financial institutions, its reputation shattered by the Banking Royal Commission. And one jab could have saved her. The heart-wrenching account of a young father whose wife died of the flu.
In a 4 to 6 hour window, she went from having the flu to being in an induced coma on a respirator with 30% lung capacity. Like, what the hell?
But first, tensions over China are spilling onto Australian university campuses with more clashes between students. In Hobart this lunchtime, Project Beijing students are calling for the University of Tasmania to take down posters put up by a group backing the democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong. Queensland University witnessed violent clashes between groups of Chinese students last month, and today a prominent government backbencher has warned that Australia's sovereignty and freedoms will be diminished unless we confront China's influence. Felicity Ogilvie in Hobart begins our coverage.
As the streets of Hong Kong are filled with the violence and noise of mass demonstrations against Beijing's rule, thousands of kilometres away in Hobart, one student from Hong Kong is carrying out his own quiet protest.
At first, I just want to show my support to all the recent protests in Hong Kong, but I didn't expect there would be such a big voice around the campus.
But the student, who didn't want to use his name, says the posters don't last long.
Until now, it has been ripped off. So basically, now as student now, there's nothing.
He says a student from China has admitted in a WeChat group that he pulled down the posters. Now the Tasmania Association of Chinese Students and Scholars has written a statement, formally asking the University of Tasmania to remove the pro-Hong Kong posters.
Our student union has formally expressed strong dissatisfaction to the school about the campus insult to China and called on the school to build a clean and pure learning environment for students.
The statement says the group respects freedom of speech, but that China deserves respect.
Everyone has freedom of speech and we will respect different voices. However, freedom of speech does not mean malicious slander, exaggeration of facts and personal attacks.
The World Today has asked the Tasmania Association of Chinese Students and Scholars Association, which is regarded as pro-Beijing, for an interview. The Tasmania University Union has called for calm. Its president is Sharifa Syed Rohan.
I think between the two cohorts affected by this, I think there's a significant amount of tension for other students. They may not be completely aware of what is happening. But I think that at the end of the day, we're all committed to ensuring that our campus promotes respectful behaviour and values one another's opinion.
The University of Tasmania is the latest campus to experience tensions between pro- and anti-Beijing student groups. At the University of Queensland, punches were thrown during a pro-Hong Kong protest. One student has told the media his parents in China got a visit, warning him not to go to any more protests. The Australia Director at Human Rights Watch, Elaine Pearson, is concerned about the Chinese government monitoring students abroad.
Human Rights Watch has been working on these issues for some years. We conducted more than 100 interviews with academics, students from China, Chinese scholars in the US, UK, Canada and Australia. And what we found is that, you know, many times for students from China, the repressive apparatus of the Chinese state really follows them to campuses abroad. We found that surveillance and monitoring on these campuses is rife, that students are, you know, discouraged from speaking up on, you know, certain issues that they are concerned about or from participating in protests or certain events. And so we really set out a 12-point code of conduct on how universities need to address these issues head on. And it's about strengthening academic freedom on campuses. It's about countering threats to academic freedom. It's also about encouraging students to, you know, address any direct or indirect attempts to censor certain discussions.
The university disputes come as the head of a parliamentary intelligence committee warns Australia against underestimating China. Liberal MP Andrew Hastie has written an opinion piece in Nine newspapers saying Australia needs to hold on to democratic convictions and national security, as well as maintaining trade with China.
Felicity Ogilvie. We've just heard those comments from Liberal MP Andrew Hastie. The Prime Minister has now responded. Let's go to our reporter in Canberra, Stephanie Boris. Stephanie, what has Scott Morrison had to say about these concerns raised by a member of his government?
The Prime Minister says Andrew Hastie is free to make these comments as a member of the backbench and in no way has shut them down. Now, these comments, as mentioned there, have been written in an opinion piece in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Andrew Hastie warning that Australia's freedoms are in danger if action isn't taken, and he's compared the world's approach to China's growing power to the West's failure to stop the rise of Nazi Germany, saying there is much more work to be done and that Australia's greatest vulnerability lies in our thinking, pointing to parliaments, universities and businesses. So when Scott Morrison was asked whether more action was needed, he actually referred to comments he himself made earlier this year. They weren't as forthcoming as Andrew Hastie's, just a bit more diplomatic and cautious.
These issues are not new, and the challenges in doing this are not new. They're well known to the government, and they're things that the government has been very proactive about now for some time. And we will continue to work to have a cooperative arrangement with China.
So that's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. Stephanie, senior Liberal MP, Labor MPs have also reacted to Andrew Hastie's comments. What are they saying?
Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been out this morning and he's labelled Andrew Hastie's comments as extreme, overblown and unwelcome. Now, Mr. Chalmers does agree that the issues at play are serious, but he fears that Mr. Hastie's comments could make it harder for Australia to manage its relationship with China.
There are lots of complex issues at play here. We shouldn't pretend that there aren't. They are multi-layered. There are economic issues, security issues and all of the rest of it. I think the onus is on all of us to use measured, sober, clear-headed language rather than go for a sensational headline.
And just on another national security matter today, it's been announced that the Australian Signals Directorate Chief, Mike Burgess, will become Australia's new Director General of ASIO. So Mr. Burgess will replace retiring Chief Duncan Lewis.
Stephanie Boris, our reporter there in Canberra. Thank you. The wealth management company AMP was once one of Australia's most trusted financial institutions. Today it's posted a $2.3 billion loss as misconduct revealed in last year's Financial Services Royal Commission continues to erode its reputation. The half-year loss comes as AMP continues to compensate customers hurt by misconduct, and $3 billion in cash has flowed out of the business as clients look for someone else to manage their money. The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, spoke with the AMP chief executive this morning. Peter is with me now. Peter, what does a $2.3 billion loss say about the level of trust in AMP now?
Well, Eleanor, rebuilding trust is Francesco De Ferrari's life at the moment. He was recruited as AMP CEO last year at the height of the Royal Commission revelations after AMP lost its chairman, chief executive and couple of board members as part of the Fees for No Service scandal. So here's a new broom dealing with a $2.3 billion loss in the first half, $3 billion in cash pulled out of the business and big write-downs from impairments. So there's now what AMP calls a transformation program underway, and this morning plans were announced for a $650 million capital raising and a deal to sell AMP's life insurance business for $3 billion. So all of this is critical. I spoke to Francesco De Ferrari this morning after the results hit, and he agreed the AMP turnaround is both difficult and challenging.
It is, and today I think is a historic day for our company. We are drawing a line in the sand as to a lot of the legacy and past issues.
Given that you've suffered a $2.3 billion loss, what assurances can you give that this is the worst from the Royal Commission or as you say, legacy issues?
Well, we have taken a significant impairment to reset the business. I've gone out to talk to a lot of our investors over the last 8 months. They all had one resounding ask: draw a line in the sand. That is what we're doing today to put all our legacy issues behind us.
What assurances have you had to give to big investors and regulators about AMP's financial stability, given that you're having to raise $650 million from the market to shore the company up?
We are not raising capital because of our capital position. We are raising capital because we want to start implementing our new strategy today.
AMP has suffered cash outflows of $3 billion as clients take their money elsewhere. That's surely a barometer about the lack of trust in AMP.
Clearly, this company has suffered a significant trust issue with its client as a consequence of the Royal Commission. We are very focused on regaining the trust of our clients, one interaction at a time.
Is the AMP brand salvageable given the reputational damage from the Royal Commission?
I absolutely believe that the AMP brand is one of the strongest assets that this company has.
You've struck a new deal to sell AMP Life to Resolution Life for a lower $3 billion. How do you counter concerns from investors and people who only know AMP as a life insurance business that you might be taking a risk by selling off AMP's bread and butter?
I hear everybody's concern. This is a business that's had very volatile earnings. We are not the best owner to underwrite those risks from a capital perspective.
How long have you been given to turn AMP around and get that share price higher?
I will be given as long as it takes.
The corporate regulator ASIC is investigating a number of potential criminal breaches stemming from the Royal Commission. Are you bracing for current or former AMP executives to face potential civil or criminal charges?
We work constructively with all the regulators, and we are very focused on dealing with these legacy issues and facing them head on so we can put the past behind us as quickly as possible.
And that's the AMP Chief Executive Francesco De Ferrari with the ABC's Peter Ryan. And Peter Ryan is still with me in the studio. Peter, AMP's share price has been on a roller coaster since the Royal Commission. What's happened today?
Well, not too much today because AMP is in a trading halt because of that $650 million capital raising. But it closed yesterday at $1.73 a share. That's down from August last year when the price had recovered to $3.52 after the fees for no service scandal. Francesco De Ferrari, who we heard just then, is under a lot of pressure, of course, to get the share price back up, and that's because his long-term incentives of around $7 million are riding on that recovery.
Indeed. And AMP executives must be worried about falling interest rates around the world, particularly that surprise cut by New Zealand's central bank.
Yes, central banks are cutting. Yesterday, cuts from India, Thailand, and also across the ditch in New Zealand with a half a percentage point cut, with the Reserve Bank of New Zealand governor saying negative rates were possible. Of course, AMP says that means wealth management becomes even more critical as clients scramble for safe returns in a low rates world.
Peter Ryan, the ABC's senior business correspondent, thank you. So is Australia headed into negative interest rate territory? And is that good or bad for borrowers and the economy? Stephen Kokoulis is the Managing Director of Market Economics and advised former Labor Prime Minister Julia Gillard. He joined me from Canberra. Stephen Kokoulis, welcome back to The World Today.
Thank you very much.
So central banks around the world are slashing rates, and there's now even talk of negative interest rates. What are negative interest rates?
Negative interest rates are set by central banks as a discouragement to the banking system of depositing money with them and instead encouraging them to lend it to the private sector. So they're a penalty, if you like, for hoarding cash. And they're really designed because the economy is so very, very weak that they want the banks and financial institutions to lend money to households, to lend money to businesses, to kickstart the economy. They're a sign of poor economic times.
So essentially the central bank is charging the commercial banks to leave their money with them.
That's correct. They're charging the banks a fee to preserve their capital. Negative interest rates in Europe, Japan, Switzerland and Sweden work by charging a fee, the negative interest rate, on banks who put their money with the central bank.
So if the commercial banks are being charged by the central bank to keep their money there, why wouldn't they just do the equivalent of putting their money under the bed?
Well, they can't because they're holding many, many billions of euros, billions of yen, billions of dollars, and they have to put it somewhere. They can't just keep it in an account with no counterparty. So they must either lend it to the private sector, or they must keep it with the central bank. There are no other alternatives.
So what could this mean for a bank consumer borrowing to buy a home or to fund a business?
The interesting thing is that it's not really passed on to the average consumer. If you're a householder with a mortgage, or you're a small business or a large business even, borrowing money to fund your expansion, you still have to pay a positive interest rates. Now, rates are extremely low. They're only 0.5% to 1.5% in Europe and around Japan and those other economies that currently have negative rates.
So we won't see a situation in Australia where a borrower can actually make money by borrowing from a bank?
I think that's unlikely. And in an interesting way, what these very low interest rates are doing, and even the negative yields that we're seeing around parts of the world, it's putting the risk onto the borrower. It's putting the risk onto people who are taking advantage of these, you know, incredibly low interest rates to buy assets, to buy a house, to expand their business. And if those things go pear-shaped and they lose money, that's where the risk is. It's not the bank losing money. It'll still be the private sector individual who borrowed at these very low rates that does lose the money.
So in some ways it sounds like a borrower's dream, but it's actually quite risky.
There is an element of risk. Remember that with the economy weak, there are extremely volatile circumstances in stock markets, for example. House prices, which have been generally buoyant around the world, not just here in Australia over recent years, they can fall. We're seeing that in Sydney and Melbourne at the moment. If you're borrowing money at these very low interest rates, thinking that it's going to be the proverbial no-brainer to make money, beware.
Stephen Kakoulis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And that's economist Stephen Kakoulis, the Managing Director of Market Economics. This is The World Today. And if you miss a program or you're just joining us now, you can find all our stories on the ABC Listen app. Or you can subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And you can follow me at Eleanor Hall 1. Now to the tensions building on the subcontinent. Pakistan has expelled India's ambassador and suspended bilateral trade with its arch rival as the latest spat between the nuclear-armed neighbours intensifies. The Pakistani government's move is in response to the Indian government stripping its portion of the contested Kashmir region of its special status. Barney Porter has the latest.
Amid India's security lockdown in Kashmir, hundreds of poor migrant workers have begun fleeing the region to return to faraway villages in northern and eastern India. There was no work there for many days, this man says, and we didn't have any food for the last 4 days. One day, locals entered our room and started to beat us and told us to leave. For others finding refuge in Pakistan-administered Kashmir, the cross-border shelling remains a constant threat. There is enough room here for all family members to hide easily, this mother says. But at times we have to accommodate neighbours as well who don't have these bunkers. Not too many bullets have hit this shelter, the woman's mother-in-law says. 2-3 shells have landed nearby, but none of them have pierced it. India has been battling insurgents in Kashmir for 30 years. It says the special status has hindered Kashmir's development, and it now wants to fully integrate the region with the rest of the country. Back in Pakistan, the politicians are having their say. Their parliament has passed a resolution condemning New Delhi's move. Pakistan has also said it will expel India's ambassador and suspend bilateral trade with India. The railway minister, Sheikh Rashid Ahmed, has pushed the rhetoric even further. Kashmiri people will not accept this removal of freedom, he says. Now we will have to see how we can fight this Hitler-like Nazism. Neighbours China and Pakistan also claim parts of Kashmir. They've voiced fierce opposition to India's removal of the constitutional provision. The US has issued a statement calling for calm and restraint, saying it supports direct dialogue between India and Pakistan on the disputed region. And the British Foreign Minister, Dominic Raab, is already talking directly to regional leaders.
Well, I've spoken to the Indian Foreign Minister, in fact, twice since my appointment, and I spoke to him earlier today. We've expressed some of our concerns around the situation and called for calm, but also had a clear readout of the situation from the perspective of the Indian government.
The immediate challenge for the Indian state is to figure out how to deal with the very real threat of unrest in Kashmir.
Michael Kugelman is the Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Eventually, India will need to ease its grip on Kashmir, and what happens then? The other issue here is Pakistan. How might Pakistan respond? Will it try to use some of its militant assets to try to cause trouble inside Kashmir? Or will it be happy with mounting a diplomatic campaign to try to get the world to condemn India? That remains to be seen, but those are the two key issues. How will India deal with the very real risk of unrest in Kashmir, and how will it deal with potential responses?
And with President Trump already facing challenging relationships with China, Iran, Russia and North Korea, Mr. Kugelman says it's unlikely Washington will lead any international charge to broker a peace deal.
You should have a third party offering to mediate what is essentially a deep-seated dispute between two nuclear armed rivals. However, the U.S.-India relationship is a key factor here. The U.S. is intent on really deepening its relationship with India. And Washington knows that India does not want any type of third-party mediation. And so I think that the U.S. has been very careful and will continue to be careful about not trying to appear to want to be a mediator.
That puts the ball back in Pakistan and India's court. And with four official wars between them since the end of the Second World War, an early breakthrough seems equally unlikely.
Barney Porter. To Queensland now, where a grieving husband and father of three is issuing a plea to Australians who haven't yet had the flu shot. Dan Folds says his fit, healthy wife died within days of contracting influenza and that one jab could have saved her. Queensland Health says at least 83 Queenslanders have died from influenza this year, making it the worst year on record. In Brisbane, Rachel Mealy reports.
Dan Fold's wife, Jacinta, first became sick last week.
The first 3 days was just a runny nose, a sore throat, a bit of a cough. And then she started getting a bit worse, and I said, right, it's time to go to the doctor.
The doctor told her she'd contracted influenza A and sent her home to rest and told her to drink plenty of fluids. Dan Fold says his wife slept a lot in the days that followed but didn't appear to be improving.
Then she rings me at 8:30 yesterday morning and I ask her if she's all right and she's like, no, not really, I don't know. She was unsure, she was just sounded off, so I jumped straight in the ute and I headed straight home. I walked in the door, took one look at her and knew I had to ring an ambulance, so I rang an ambulance.
After arriving at the Toowoomba Hospital, doctors told Dan Folds that his wife's organs were shutting down and that it was best for her to be put in an induced coma.
We got to say our last words together. We told each other we loved each other and she apologised. And I said, don't be sorry. And after that, they put her out and she crashed in a 4 to 6 hour window. She went from having the flu to being in an induced coma on a respirator with 30% lung capacity. Like, what the hell?
He says his three children have been left without a mother and he wants to warn others about the importance of the flu shot.
The flu shot, I always thought it was a load of crap. I know me and my kids will be getting the flu shot forever. And if you sit, go to the doctor, if it's longer than 2 days, you don't feel right, nothing's improved, just go to the doctor. Because it's not a joke, this stuff kills. Like, we're just an average family.
Queensland Health says there have been at least 83 deaths from influenza this year, making it the worst on record. Paul Van Binder is a professor in the School of Medicine at Griffith University and an expert in influenza and vaccination. He told ABC Brisbane the statistics underaccount for the numbers of deaths.
Well, Australia-wide, we expect that there'll be about 4,000 deaths this year from influenza because it is a bad season. Many, many of those deaths, and the vast majority, don't get recorded as such. They occur in people over the age of 65 and 70 who have other chronic conditions. And often what happens with influenza is, in fact, it makes their heart disease worse or their respiratory disease worse and they pass away. Nobody takes a swab and they're just put down to people dying of their conditions. But it's influenza that tips the balance.
Professor Van Binder is also urging doctors to more readily prescribe the antiviral medication Tamiflu when they see patients with influenza.
there's a view in the Australian community which is wrong, that only if you give Tamiflu within a day or two does it make any difference. And that might be right for people who have mild disease that are going to recover in 3 or 4 days. But if you have severe disease, I mean, if you're struggling to move, you have severe aches, your temperature's 41 or 42, you're starting to get short of breath, you need an antiviral then, not at the time when somebody says we better put you into a coma to see if we can save you that way.
That's Professor Paul Van Binder from Griffith University. That report from Rachel Mealy in Brisbane. And that's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. Sally Sara and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a safe afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ruby Jones, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Protesters have been shutting down streets in Hong Kong for going on 9 weeks now.
Yeah, and these protests started over a controversial extradition bill that people saw as China trying to erode the city's freedoms.
Even though that plan's been shelved, protests have continued, and if anything, gotten worse.
So what's going to end Hong Kong's slide into chaos, and how long until China flexes its muscle?
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.